Well, you'll be like a car. You got a hubcap, diamond star halo. You'll be like a car, oh yeah. Get it on, bang a gong, get it on.
All right. We're going to be speaking with Guy McPherson soon. And to lead up to that, I'm interviewing Wolf, who would like to talk about the climate rally in New York City he just attended. And welcome. Good greetings to you. Hi, how are you?
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Carl. My name is Wolf, James Stark Wolf, and just got back on the People's Climate train last night to Emeryville. I was on the train for 4 days, coming back from Manhattan and 400,000 strong People's Climate March, which was a wonderful event. The climate was with us. The day was beautiful, and it was almost possible to forget the chaos that we're in.
Is that on Sunday?
Yeah, it was on Sunday.
So I was reading there's also goings on Monday.
And Monday I also was over on Wall Street in front of the New York Stock Exchange and the federal bank, and when I got there in the morning, I knew that I was going to have to get back to Penn Station to jump on the climate change train home. So I saw that the New York police were picking off people in ones and twos and busing them, but that was not going to be me, because I had to be on the train and had train tickets, and didn't want to be stranded in jail in Lower Manhattan and in Wall Street. But
right.
I think they waited until the business day was over to do the mass arrests.
I don't know how many were arrested. I thought I only read like 40 people.
That
but you
could
said
be. That could be. I had heard 100, but this was rumors on the train.
It's different.
And the train
sources.
Itself was a really great experience.
Oh,
there were, I guess, about 200 people to Chicago from the west on the first train, and then that left on Monday, and on the Tuesday there were about 20 of us, and then everything doubled in Chicago. There were people coming from Milwaukee and all over the place.
Wonderful.
So it was a really great experience. And my only frame of reference was that it was about two times the size of a average San Francisco anti-Vietnam War moratorium. So 400,000 seemed pretty much like what I would think that would look like. It stretched all
closer
the way
closer to that amount. Yeah, it seemed.
Yeah,
yeah. And where did you find yourself in the midst of that?
Near the front of the parade was youth and children, and then right behind that were indigenous people, Indians and Maoris, and I was with a big ceremonial of Azteca dancers that went from Central Park dancing 30-40 blocks, and they had a big statue about 12 feet high of Cuatlique, or one of the mothers of the gods, I think. I don't know if I'm pronouncing. And the whole circle was filled with copal and conches and drums, and then dancers that dance the whole strip right through Times Square, and it was really, really big.
Can you sum up how you got you know, involved in that?
Like, you know, I just heard about this train going a couple days ahead of time, and friends of mine were going from Idle No More, Penny from the Bay Area, and
right.
And so at the last minute, I had the opportunity, and I want to thank Center for Biological Diversity that helped subsidize and brought the prices down for the people a lot. And there was also a Buddhist group, and I'm not sure who they were, but I'm grateful they were able to do that.
Well, that's really excellent. I'm glad
thank
you told
you.
Us about
well,
that, James. Well,
and on the train, like, also, mm-hmm. I would just say quickly that there were workshops that were organized on the first train, and on the second train, we were able to kind of spontaneously organize workshops, and I got to talk a little bit about the message of our next guest, Guy McPherson.
Well, great. You could lead it into that. I'd like to include Guy McPherson now.
Hey, Carl.
Hey.
It's good to be here. Sorry I'm late.
It's good to see you. Yeah. Guy McPherson, I should have this memorized because he's been here, and he's really here. And Guy McPherson, conservation biologist, professor emeritus of University of Arizona. But he's a current radio host. Is that right?
Yes, I do have a radio show along with my co-host Mike Sleeve. It broadcasts on the Progressive Radio Network out of New York City.
Right, and you have a forthcoming book, Extinction Dialogues, How to Live with Death in Mind, coming up in October this year, coming
yes,
out.
Yes, I just received my first copy of it a couple of days ago. The publisher came down from the Bay Area and had a copy for me. That's written with Carolyn Baker. So it's a
so if it meets
book.
Your approval, then it'll be released soon. Is that right?
It's already sort of released. He had a few copies at an event where I was speaking, and we're doing a book signing tomorrow at Pilgrim's Way between 1 and 3 p.m. tomorrow.
That's at Carmel, and then there'll be books the next day, Sunday, at the big event in Santa Cruz.
Yeah, and which is at the Resource Center for Nonviolence, and that's at 5 o'clock. I hope that's right.
3 to 5. Come at 5 if you want to hear us say the end.
Dun, 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 dun. Okay.
That would be worth it. No. But at the beginning, too.
Sometimes I say the end right at the beginning, just so people know what I'm talking about.
Whatever yeah. time you come to one of Guy's talks, you're coming at the end. Right?
We also have an audience in the studio right now. So welcome, everybody.
We have a live studio audience, and the person chiming in every now and then is my host and organizer for this tour, Peter Melton.
Yes, exactly. Peter.
Pumpkin, it's pumpkin time of year,
got
too.
Got me going so on this.
Nice orange shirt you got there.
And I have my pumpkin shirt on.
So
anyway,
you've been
you've
been nonstop since you got. When did you get to Santa Cruz? Huh?
Well, when did they get to Santa Cruz?
We picked him up on Monday night after a long, tumultuous travel for Guy, which that we don't need to hear about. And then Monday or Tuesday, we had an event at Cabrillo College, which was great with Joe Jordan spearheading it, and Joe did a great talk about the solstice sunset, and then pointed out some beautiful planetary stuff that was going on. We tied in a sunset and sky watching into the talk.
Yeah, I was at a recent sky watch at Joe's at a place in Boulder Creek. Yeah, that was really interesting.
Yeah, and I think we had two or three events the next day.
Yeah, they were at Hartnell College for a class, a geology class in the morning, and then what was the class in the evening? Was an environmental...
Environmental geology.
Geology in the evening.
And then the public was invited to that one.
Right. So we've been mixing it up, and then we did Monterey Peninsula College yesterday. So we hit all the wonderful community colleges with students and some public.
And we had another radio interview in there somewhere.
And a radio interview with the gal from Pilgrim's Way. Cynthia Fernandez does a show out of Monterey that airs on Saturday. And we're going to be at the bookstore there in Carmel, Pilgrim's Way, on Saturday, 1 to 3. And then Saturday in Monterey at the Monterey Peace Center on Fremont Street.
And you can get the full rundown on all of these events at my website, guymcpherson.com. If you click on the coming events, which is the third tab up there on top, that'll give you the full description.
Is that your way of saying you don't want me to talk anymore?
No, I always want you to talk.
Okay, good.
Quietly in the next room.
I do believe that's one point for you, Mr. McPherson.
I was going to go right to that, but I did go to your website, and I found some videos, the recent ones, and I could go back to your website, but why don't you just say it anyway? What recently, talk about the runaway climate change going on, and what you've concluded since we last spoke in April.
Yeah, we last spoke in April. That's a long time ago on the climate science front. Since then, we've triggered several more self-reinforcing feedback loops. We're up to nearly 40 of those at this point to deal with climate change. And the most catastrophic of those is methane bubbling out of the Arctic Ocean. And the evidence has continued to increase that that's underway and apparently has gone exponential, the methane release from the Arctic Ocean. Methane is more than 100 times more powerful greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide in the short term, meaning less than 20 years or so. So that's a really, really big deal, having methane bubbling out of the Arctic Ocean as well as out of the permafrost. We also, in Russia, learned about those giant holes that you've probably seen a little bit about in the news, these three giant holes that have methane at a few million times higher than the background level of methane. There's three of these giant holes have been discovered so far. Apparently were created by salt water and methane mixing together and blowing these things out. And so, interestingly, it's in a region called Yamal, which means the end of the world.
That's what it means already.
Yes.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I thought that was quite ironic and fitting.
Since I read that you are conducting some support group on Facebook for those that wish to subscribe to, or that believe that.
Well, right. There's a group on Facebook called Near-Term Human Extinction Support Group. And it's really about support. There's an affiliated evidence page where the evidence for near-term human extinction is posted and discussed. But the support group really is for people who have accepted the notion of near-term human extinction, which really means accepting the fact that you're going to die individually. And so it's a support group. There's a great set of rules that basically involve no debate. We don't talk about this. This is for people who have accepted this idea. And there's no disparaging people for that. And so the moderators are doing a great job removing daily posts that attempt to disparage people who have accepted that they, in fact, are going to die. And that our species is going away as well in the not-too-distant future.
Right.
And so there's lots of people who come out and say, no, it's not that bad if we just, implement the principles of permaculture, and if we plant more trees, and you people are all a bunch of wackos anyway, and blah, blah, blah. So it's not that kind of place. It's intended to be a safe space.
Yeah.
And it seems to be working really very well, thanks to the attentive moderators who are paying attention there.
So how about your, if I may go back to the radio show, Nature Bats, last every Tuesday. Do you also bring that into light, that you've all accepted it, or what do you do?
Well, we don't really. My co-host, Mike Sliva, and I are trying to make Nature Bats Last on the radio the most radical show on the airwaves. And we defer to the definition of radical, which is to get to the root of. Many people think it means extremist. If you're radical, you must be throwing Molotov cocktails at buildings. That's not right. Radical just means to get to the root of.
Okay.
And so we're trying to get to the root of any number of issues. So we interview people about climate change, and we interview people about urban gardening. So we're trying to cover a wide swath of material there.
Oh, okay.
And then they have, like, what's that, the Hopium of the Week and the Doomer of the Week, and they have some fun with the show, too.
Yeah, there are several segments. We typically open with a couple of news items beyond the mainstream, and on the last show, they focused heavily on events leading up to, including, and after September 11th, 2001. And then we bring on typically Forrest Palmer and occasionally Lindsay Morrison and occasionally Alexis from Alexandria to offer bits called Breaking Hopium. And these are people, women or men of color, or, well, the three include a Caucasian woman, an African-American woman, and an African-American man. And so they have a perspective that I can't have, because I'm a white man in what, from the perspective of the monetary system and in a position of privilege, it's a white man's world. And so I can't even imagine what it's like to be in one of these groups that is oppressed. And so we like to bring in these other voices to tell us what it's like to be in the oppressed crowd. And so we have these contributions that are just 2 to 4 minutes long and describe the world from my perspective this week, that sort of thing. Then we have a relatively long interview, 30 or 40 minutes. Last week it was eco-psychologist Jiwa Woodbury. This coming week it will be environmental activist and writer Corey Morningstar from Canada. And then after that we have an update on the climate change front. What have we learned in the last week or so about abrupt climate change? And we begin and end with a song written specifically for me and for the show called Nature Bats Last by a guy named Afrazin in South Africa.
Oh, that's really good. To that. Yeah.
It's a great little tune. It's at prn.fm. That's the internet location for the Progressive Radio Network. It also airs in the Manhattan area every Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time.
Huh. I did go to the website there.
And there's
set
a,
up
there's
right
a
now.
Pretty complete collection of archives at this point for the, I guess, 7 or 8 weeks we've been on the air. It's been a relatively short run so far. And they're all archived at naturebatslast.podbean.com, which is a relatively mainstream podcasting archive site.
Is there a link at your site, Guy?
Oh, yes.
For all these?
A link at Nature Bats Last to the radio show. Yes.
Yeah. You have... Okay.
And what have you guys been doing? Is this a new show, Coral, that you guys have started recently?
Well, I don't know if you mean new, but...
didn't
within
you do
his
a
lifetime.
new show, Char? What did...
Yes. my former co-host, who has his own show now, he's had different show names, but his latest one is Church of the Biochar.
There you go. I knew there was some char in there. It wasn't Cher. It's Char.
I think he investigated more after speaking with you last time when you're here.
Uh-huh.
But he put some humor into it. He put some bell gongs and some, rapture stuff. So. But he tries to use some science.
Right. And we use biochar at the homestead where I live in New Mexico. We have a biochar kiln, and we make biochar and incorporate it into the soil as a soil amendment to improve soil productivity and also to try to keep some of that carbon dioxide from going up into the atmosphere. So it serves two functions.
About what percent of the chance that it's helping? That's not how I want to say it. How much is it helping curb that?
Well, since we're such a small operation, essentially none. You know, it's one of those cases where individual actions, unless millions and millions of people get on board, they just don't make much difference.
Yep.
So had we as a society, after World War II, used biochar instead of the Haber-Bosch process to fertilize our soils, then we would be nowhere close to global peak oil and nowhere close to runaway climate change. But that's a decision that was made poorly more than 60 years ago, and we can't turn back the clock. So now we use fossil fuel-based fertilizer instead of biochar.
Yeah, with our addiction, like I think I read that in your website, like an abused parent, an addiction to oil, like compared to alcoholism or something like that.
Right.
That the latest talks... the latest reports, and especially about this climate rally, was that the networks are not discussing, especially Republicans, the right wing, because all they see are the people that were there, long hair, brown colored, hippie looking, who knows what, liberals there. So, any
turquoise wearing,
yeah,
cowboy hat, leather vest wearing.
It's not easy.
Oh, we're describing
you,
James.
They're not going to subscribe to it, even though 400,000 were there. They're going to,
Yeah, you know, we were talking about that a little earlier, and Guy, you should share your thoughts about what the rally is or does, and who funds it, and pull your string on that one.
Well, it was heavily funded by Avaaz and the Rockefellers.
Right.
By Big Oil.
Oh.
And Corey Morningstar will be talking about this in depth this coming Tuesday on
the
radio
interesting.
Show.
Yeah.
And she's written quite a lot about it. And pointing out that, you know, there are four stages for movements to get traction, and the stages are: conduct research, educate the public, organize, and then act. And we've known about climate change for a long time, and we seem to be stuck in education, and the march and the protests and all of that that we've seen recently is still education. Now, we're not going to educate a whole bunch of people. You know, the people you mentioned earlier who are disparaging those at the march, the Fox News types, they're not going to be educated ever, so it's time to move along.
Okay.
So it's time to leave some children behind, the No Child Left Behind Act notwithstanding. And it's time to move beyond educating people who already know or who will never accept the information that's out there. And it's time to organize and time to act instead of continuing to educate. That's Corey's perspective, and I largely agree with it. I'm not saying that I don't appreciate those who marched. I think it was probably a great party. You're out there with like-minded people.
Yeah.
And sort of building your energy and your enthusiasm. But I think we need to move to some future steps as well. And we've been stuck at research and education for a long time. We don't seem to be making much progress. And as Malcolm X pointed out, you don't march with your oppressors. And when Rockefeller is doing the funding, that's Big Oil. That seems like the oppressors to me.
Which people are not recognizing that's who funded it? I mean, is it just...
Well, you never see it in the mainstream media. They don't report that the Rockefellers were paying $200,000 to put advertisements up in the subway system in New York City to encourage people to show up. Right,
and the Pentagon at one time, they created the signs "Thanks for not smoking" for covering up the broken ozone layer. That's what I read. So it's usually what happens. I just kind of like make it look like the other side.
Right, and it's so easy to manipulate public opinion in a culture that has grown up with advertising. It's the United States of advertising. We advertise, we pay for something like 50% of the advertising that goes on in the world goes on in the United States. So we pay attention to advertising. In Western European countries, for example, before you graduate high school, in most of those countries, you're required to take a course in media criticism, so that you understand what the media is up to, and you understand that they're selling something. And in this country, nobody is ever required to take a media criticism course. And so we just keep buying all this nonsense that is spewed out by the advertising agencies, meaning the mainstream media and the government.
Each generation, it's like it rehashed too. I mean, it's sort of not anything new, but it's just a new form of it or something.
Sure. More of the same.
You can even make money on what used to be, make money. I don't know. You know, in the popular medium, mm-hmm. like music and movies and themes and stuff.
Right.
You know, like that.
We have monetized everything at this point.
You
know,
yeah.
We've monetized the water. We've monetized the airwaves. We put a monetary price on everything, including things that are priceless.
And so we've all become resources.
Yes.
To be bought and sold.
It wasn't that long ago, institutions had what they called personnel departments. Nobody does that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
They have departments of human resources, because we are all resources. We are all cogs. And that's a really bizarre way to view the world. When white-tailed deer and salmon and redwood trees become resources, we no longer are able to have a relationship with them that goes beyond consumption. We should view them as relations, the other R word. They are relations. They are not our resources. And had we...
Yeah.
If we adopted that way of thinking and stuck with it, 40 or 50 or 100 years ago, the world would be a lot different place.
So, it was a switchover from one way of being all, everyone could do a lot of things and contributed, and now, you just specialize in something. It's more like that.
Right. We're cogs. We're cogs in the machine.
If you're not perfect at something, something's wrong. I don't know.
and we really don't do, the education leader and philosopher Howard Gardner wrote many years ago a paper called The Seven Kinds of Intelligence, or Seven Different Intelligences. And he has subsequently expanded that to include three more. So he now acknowledges that there are 10 kinds of intelligence. And in the K-12 indoctrination system known as the public education system in the United States, we focus on two of those, mathematical, logical, and linguistics. Nothing else matters. If you're interested in musical intelligence, that's an extracurricular activity. That's not required.
No.
Yeah, but it's clearly an intelligence. Some people are better at it than others, and it can be improved for almost everybody. And some people are more talented in these different arenas than others. And one of the things that we ignore or disparage is introspection, what Howard Gardner calls intrapersonal intelligence, the ability to know ourselves, to look within ourselves and figure out what it means to be a human being in the vastness that is the universe.
All right.
Some people are very good at that, but the culture we live in does not reward it or encourage it.
Yeah.
And one step deeper, as has been coming up on the talks with regard to that topic, is near-term human extinction brings you to this place of needing and wanting to investigate who am I amidst the fact that somewhere between 20 and 50 years from now, we're in a completely different world. Okay, that's all you got to buy into to be aware of, wow, what does that bring up in my humanity? How can I sit with this happening while I'm here, and what does that bring up for me?
Yeah, and those that are just starting to accept, that it might be a possibility. It's not that they feel forced to have to decide one way or another,
right. But
it's more or less, why don't you just look at what you can do?
Right, dare to look at it. And the analogy I just love with all that is the Titanic analogy, where Guy was saying last night, the Titanic's hit the iceberg. And now the captain is saying, oh, excuse me, okay, everyone, we've hit an iceberg, we're going down, not sure how long, the boat's going to stay afloat, dinner will not be served, but there is a band in the lounge. Have a good day.
And
so the question becomes, who are you? Who do you become in that moment? And there's no right or wrong way to do your life now, but you get to decide with the awareness of we're going down. You get to decide, who am I?
I'm glad you brought that up because I thought of both of you, and I brought three different types of music. I brought
Black. That was the guy who dead the whole time, and you didn't know it. Oh, if you didn't see that movie, I'm sorry. Spoiler alert! Ended better. Back yourself up.
And then Miles Davis, Kind of Blue. Now, I just wondered which of these, you know, moods are we in? Are we meeting Joe Black, who is talking about how to cope with death? Are we just kind of blue and, you know, kind of have
My answer to this and what continues to come up is the Wizard of Oz vibe, this Somewhere Over the Rainbow, What a Wonderful World, and because that's really this next
phase. Yeah, that's in there, too.
And what's happened for me personally, as I sink into what's real about this for me, or just me choosing to believe that 20 to 50 years from now, we got a new world. So who am I? Who I am is somebody who wants to see the beauty in everything. Who I am is this representation of humanity that says, oh my God, look at that animal. Look at that person. Look at this studio. Look at all we've done. And yes, we've done some other stuff too, but I want to notice the beauty and be with the beauty.
Yeah,
and
can notice it.
I don't think you'll find Miles Davis kind of blue in either of us.
No.
At least not me. People accuse me of being all doom and gloom and making everybody sad, and I must be miserable, I must be horribly sad and depressed and pathetic all the time.
You know, his first song's called So What? I have it queued up, so we can play it.
There you go. Let's start with that while we decide what other ones
we'll
just we
put it in
play.
The background here. Okay.
So What?
I'm all about number 11 on this collection called No Boundaries, a benefit for the Kosovar refugees. Number 11 is by Indigo Girls. It's called Go.
All
That's
right.
me. I'm Go.
You Go.
You know, I said in the presentation the other night, I pointed out that people think you only live once. But in fact, you only die once. You live every moment, every day. So let's live. So go works for me.
Well, we'll go then.
Yeah, do what it is that you're going to do. Be who you're going to be. Because what was the song you said you were playing? Oh, yeah, So What?
There it is.
Hello, So What?
Well, it's playing.
Great. So What means
if you
so
had the
what?
Headphones on, you hear it.
So what am I going to do now?
Are you off the air?
Right?
I just so don't what? Have it. Up so because it causes feedback. I don't have it turned up so you can. Yeah, we. Do you want to have a question? We can get at the microphone because, it'll be fine.
Because we're still talking too, even though the music's on, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yes, there's a divestment movement. The live studio audience asks the question.
Cheryl, I think your name's Cheryl. Is it Cheryl?
Cheryl in the live studio audience.
The other night
yes, I remember. I remember. Yeah, I shook her hand earlier, and she said, "I'm Cheryl. Remember?" And I said, "Yeah, kind of, sort of." Oh yeah, Cheryl. Yeah, of course I remember. But it's almost.
Yeah, it's good to see Cheryl again. Yeah.
So Cheryl asked about the divestment movement.
And I've heard that the Rockefeller Foundation has divested from fossil fuel.
Right. I too have heard that the Rockefeller Foundation has made the decision to divest from fossil fuels. And I'm trying to figure out what's going on there.
And they're investing in renewable energies is what I have heard. So maybe that is why they're behind funding the march.
Well, maybe. Although investing in, quote, renewable energy, which means solar panels and wind turbines and that sort of thing, is further investing in fossil fuels because it takes a tremendous amount of fossil fuels and rare earth minerals to make those things. And then you have the issue of maintaining the electrical grid, for example, which requires fossil fuels or some ability to store energy that has yet to be discovered.
Did you say electrical grid?
Yes. If we're going to maintain the electrical grid, the vaunted electrical grid, especially through the United States and Western Europe.
Using fossil fuel.
We have to use fossil fuels. We can use solar panels during the daytime, but unless you have a way of storing the electricity, storing the energy, you can't get off of fossil fuels, and those so-called renewables really are derivatives of fossil fuels. It takes a tremendous amount of fossil fuels to make a solar panel. to develop the energy to make the solar panels, and then you have to mine those rare earths and so on. So I don't see any way that we can power industrial civilization with derivatives, with quote renewables, and that doesn't even mention or think about the liquid fuels that are required to maintain the electric grid. So every time the wind blows or we have a big snowstorm, somebody's got to go up and restring those wires, right? And so far, we don't have a bunch of electric cars set to do that.
That reminded me of a interview with a Bolivian indigenous miner of lithium for Prius batteries, saying that she was interviewed on the radio saying that she had her first 8 babies at home, and since she went from tin mining to lithium, she had her first hospital birth, and from now on all of her babies, this hospital is the way to go, have your babies in the hospital, and with the assumption that she's going to have, you know, however many more after number 8.
Huh? That's like a new awareness for her then.
Wow. Because 9 babies isn't enough.
8 is enough.
Although,
come on, pop culture, you're pop culture.
Yes, yes, absolutely. You know, and that's not to disparage people in other countries who are having lots of babies. The resource use through a lifetime, the use of materials by an American is equivalent to 20 to 50 human beings in other parts of the world. So the Bolivian 8 babies is still much, much, much lower demand on finite materials than having 1 baby in the United States. But we're quick, people in this country are quick to point to other countries as being the source of the overpopulation problem. No, it's a combination of people and what they use.
And in the United States and Europe, they're the last to even jump on trying to change anything, according to the climate summit. I mean, that's what Africa's telling the United States.
Well, of course, because so far we aren't suffering too much. There are 5 million people a year die early deaths because of climate change, but they aren't in the United States and Western Europe because we have all this technology that keeps us cool and keeps us dry and keeps us warm and so on. So that's mostly a sub-Saharan African issues. And so, of course, in sub-Saharan Africa, if you're the family members of one of those 5 million who dies every year from climate change, then you think it's a big deal. Then you think that climate change is real and is impacting your life.
Right.
But here, we don't really have that impact going on yet, despite the fact that we're on the verge of not being able to feed our country from the vegetable basket of America, the Central Valley of California.
We were just waiting for it to hit closer to home, doing this little matrix move where we're, oh, I dodged that one. Oh, the tsunami was over there. Oh, the flood was over there. And living in our little privileged bubble, waiting for it to hit close to home.
Right.
Listening to talk radio, what's the guy that I, you know who I mean?
Wolfman Jack?
Yeah. Him. Yeah. Don't know. Guy that's denying it every day, you know.
Oh, the Rush Limbaughs of the world.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, the Rush Limbaugh.
Was I supposed to advertise for him?
I didn't want to.
Is he on this station too? Because that's how you're going to get listenership up.
Yeah. Yeah, we could throw. That's right. You'd put a little blurb from Rush, and now.
A little Sean Hannity, a little Rush Limbaugh, and we'll have you up to 1 million listeners a day
and then
in
we'll
no time.
Put a commercial from you in, and it'll just sneak it in somehow.
Coral, troublemaker.
Oh, no, me. But speaking of troublemakers, I'm glad Peter reminded me that because I asked people just send in questions, my illustrious ex partner, host, who couldn't be here today, said he might call in, but he asked me to ask you, get the timeline for when ice is gone in Greenland and Antarctica and the North Pole, and what a 2% rise means to the environment in then, and what a 4% rise would mean in 2040. That's
four
what
degrees,
I wrote.
Yeah, 2 degrees.
4 degrees. Why did I say?
Well, shout out to Freedom. Hello, Mr. Freedom. We miss you here in the studio.
Yeah.
While we're shouting out, we should say hello to Pauline.
Yes, the filmmaker and Pauline, who's undoubtedly listening right now. So,
she's got a big smile on her face because we're talking about her.
Yeah.
So, that's you, Pauline.
So those.
Yeah, I think she called in.
We have two listeners right now, and they're yet.
Yeah, a few people said thanks for your picture I put up on Facebook.
All right, so Freedom wants to know about the ice.
So the ice in the Arctic is a really, really, really big deal. And according to the UK Parliament, it's scheduled to go away in 2015, which is next year. That would be in September of next year. According to the United States Naval Postgraduate Institution, scheduled to go away in about 2016, and we're on track for this to be the sixth lowest ice cover year in history. And bear
when
in mind,
when you say go away, though, make sure we understand what that means.
Yeah, so that means an ice-free Arctic for a week or two, or some relatively short period of time in September. Of one of these Septembers. One of these Septembers, relatively soon, we're going to have an ice-free Arctic. And when we do, that will trigger tremendous warming. If we just have a little bit of ice, I mean just a little bit of ice, it absorbs a tremendous amount of heat from the sun. So imagine you're walking around at a party with your favorite drink in your hand, and your favorite drink happens to have ice cubes in it. As long as the ice cubes are there, you might walk around for an hour and the ice doesn't all melt. And so that drink is at 0 degrees centigrade the whole time. It's at freezing because it has a little bit of ice in it. Whether it's a lot of ice or a little ice. Once the ice melts, the drink warms up very, very quickly.
Got it. That's great.
And so once the ice is gone in the Arctic, the Arctic is the planet's air conditioner.
Good analogy.
Yeah. Once we lose that ice, all that heat that is being absorbed by the ice and being reflected by the white ice, once all that energy starts going into the oceans, that's going to be, we'll say, interesting.
So that's at the end of summer when it's been the hottest the longest, the ice all melts and then it starts getting colder again and the ice comes back. But for that time in September, we have a new kind of September Morn for you Neil Diamond fans. Do you have September Morn by Neil Diamond?
That'll be a good one. I'll look that one up, but I'm going to put up Go right now.
All right, go.
We'll be right back.
just heard Go by the Indigo Girls, and go, go, go.
And they went.
We're here with Guy McPherson, Peter Melton, James Wolf, a guest you... Yeah, I didn't know she wanted to be identified, but of course, Cheryl. And we had Stephen in here, and we're good for another 40 minutes here. Why not? Because there's another show coming on at 6, and I think people can start getting here. So,
what could possibly go wrong?
Well, we'll find something. And that would...
Cheryl had that question during the break about divestment. I'd love to have Guy address that a little bit more with the Rockefellers and divestment and their
good question.
Donations to the cause and whatnot. So put your cell phone down.
So, yes,
be James. Here now as you lay. The guy does not do what he says. Oh, whoops.
Oh,
pay no attention to the man behind the microphone.
I have a great face and great behavior for the radio.
For the radio. Yeah.
It's true.
So James pointed out that there's the Rockefeller Foundation that is promoting divestment, and that's a small fraction of the overall capital that is the Rockefeller Brothers. The Rockefeller Foundation is a mere drop in the bucket. And it could very well be that this is a case of greenwashing. We've seen that plenty of times before. You know what organization pays more for their sustainability program than any other? And so you could argue it has the leading sustainability program in the world.
Walmart.
Would be Walmart, exactly. And when I think of Walmart, I think
just
cheap
guessed.
Plastic crap from China. I don't think sustainability.
Right?
But they pay more for the sustainability program than any other institution. So that allows us to look at them. They're greenwashed, and they say, oh, look, they're green. They're green. Green capitalism rocks.
Who do they pay more to?
For their sustainability program. So they have a tremendous recycling program.
Oh, yeah.
And lots of marketing.
Lots of marketing payment.
and I think that's, at least in part, that's what we see going on with the Rockefeller Foundation. It makes us look good and puts a positive spin on capitalism, as long as it's green capitalism.
I have a naive question, but... Can we kind of slip nuclear power plants into the sustainability camp possibly promote nuclear energy plants as sustainable under these kinds of guidelines?
Well, many people have, including James Hansen. James Hansen thinks we so desperately need to maintain industrial civilization that we better go nuke, even though... nuclear power plants don't become carbon neutral because of the amount of concrete in the cooling towers for a couple of decades after they're built. And then they become old and rickety enough that we start shutting them down for safety reasons. And never mind that we never actually have figured out how to decommission the things. So decommissioning is an arduously slow process that has never been undertaken at scale. And you'd have thought Three Mile Island maybe was strike one, and Chernobyl was strike two, and Fukushima was strike three, but we just keep doubling down. We haven't figured out what to do with the waste from nuclear power, and it lasts essentially forever. It's going to be around for a couple million years in the case of plutonium. And we don't know how to deal with it, but we just keep forging ahead. So, yes, some people have painted it as the green way to go, but...
We keep taking more risks with nuclear power, but the green people think it's green think that because you can do it in a green way, it's
right, our whole,
safer.
Our whole notion of green and sustainable came out of this idea that we could somehow sustain what the status quo. That maybe if we did some things differently, we could keep roughly the same set of living arrangements, but do it in a more friendly way, earth-friendly way, where what appears to be the case is that it's the whole industrial civilization that is what's the challenge, and we keep coming up with ideas of solutions that are keeping us stuck in the same way of being.
Right. Thinking we can sustain the unsustainable, and any civilization is unsustainable, and industrial civilization is the least sustainable of all. It relies completely upon ready access to inexpensive oil, for example, to be maintained. Well, it's a fossil fuel. That means it doesn't last forever. Right? And we're beyond the inexpensive stuff at this point and into the expensive stuff. And so it's getting more and more difficult to maintain the status quo. So some people defer to nuclear as a means to maintain the status quo. But this is not the only way to live. This is the way we've lived for a very short period of time, depending upon what you include in this way of living. If we're talking smartphones, we're talking about less than a decade. If we're talking about cars on the road, we're talking about 150 years or so. If we're talking about grid-tied electricity for everybody in the country, we're talking about the last 50 or 60 years is all. And so this is a relatively short event that we have undertaken so far, and it will not be sustained because fossil fuels are fossil fuels. And so there is a different way to live, and we're going to find out that there are different ways to live, but apparently only when we're forced to do so, when we actually bump up hard against the constraints that were mentioned in the 1972 report by the Club of Rome about limits to growth. Well, we're bumping up hard against them now, and we're discovering that maintaining this set of living arrangements requires tremendous imperialism and money that we don't have.
Yeah, and it's just a civilization, the Western mindset that's keeping that notion going, and they think that they're probably immune from getting any kind of diseases that are, I wonder, launched in undeveloped countries. Where I'm hearing, about the Ebola virus, and that it's different than we all are led to believe it is, and I don't know what I know the truth about that, but that maybe.
Well, even mainstream large organizations like the CDC and the World Health Organization are warning that things have gone beyond our ability to control with respect to Ebola.
Yes, what I'm reading.
And there's all sorts of interactions between climate change and infectious disease.
Yes.
You raise the minimum temperature just a little bit, and suddenly you've alleviated a constraint that allows for mosquitoes that carried hemorrhagic dengue fever, previously restricted to Central and South America, to equatorial regions. Now they can reach North America. Now suddenly we have malaria in Florida and in places where it wasn't found before. And now Lyme disease has gone rampant throughout much of the country, whereas up until a decade ago or so, it was largely restricted to the northeastern United States and a little bit in the southeast. Now it's everywhere. So you see these interactions as global average temperature rises, constraints are alleviated on infectious disease, and now all of a sudden we have all kinds of problems. Enough money to deal with them. We have nuclear power plants that are constantly on the verge of falling apart. And it's not just Fukushima, it's San Onofre in Southern California. It's Fort Calhoun in Nebraska that a couple of years ago came within a hair's breadth of being flooded by the Missouri River when it flooded, being overwhelmed. And so we see these increased storm intensities, and
throw in an earthquake or two, and
right, and suddenly we're in crisis mode all the time. Always somewhere there's a crisis, and even 15 years ago, it was a big news story when there's a crisis somewhere. Now there's a crisis every 20 minutes. The mainstream media can't keep up with the distractions that are being thrown at us.
So some of the distractions are hard to keep track of, because some of them are distractions. Which ones are the real ones, and which ones do we need to pay attention to that affect us all the time?
Right, and that's exactly right.
Wonder how your paddle discussion this Sunday will start treating that topic. Will you all work together, or will it be separate? I guess it's a panel, huh?
Well, we get to meet tonight with the panel, so that will be exciting to begin to blend the ideas and wisdom of the panel members and to begin to shape what can we do with the panel? What's the best use of our time together?
Oh, yeah.
And so we'll be looking into that a little bit.
And it's interesting. I suspect.
Yeah.
Most of the resistance I get when I write and speak about abrupt climate change, most of the resistance comes from white men my age or so. People in that group are benefiting the most, are the most privileged from this set of living arrangements. And so I get a lot of pushback there. And I point out frequently that Tim Garrett wrote an excellent paper in 2007, subsequently published in Climatic Change, one of the leading journals in the field. And in that paper, he points out that only collapse of industrial civilization prevents runaway climate change. So if there's any hope at preventing runaway climate change, and I don't think there is at this point, but if there is, it's through collapse of industrial civilization. And nobody I talk to, at least among white men, thinks that's a good idea. So I suspect the members of the panel will say, no, we have to use civilized approaches to deal with climate change. Well, industrial civilization is at the root of the predicament known as climate change. Civilization is a heat engine, as Garrett pointed out in his excellent work. And so we have to terminate civilization to avoid runaway climate change.
And by runaway climate change, you're saying that the temperatures can just change radically in 2 or 3 days, suddenly.
Well, in a matter of years. So,
yeah.
So 55 million years ago, there was an event in which, within a span of 13 years, temperature rose 5 degrees centigrade. That was global average. That's pretty fast. Paul Beckwith, climate scientist who studies methane coming out of the Arctic Ocean at the University of Ottawa, predicted in October 2012 that we could see a 6 degree centigrade temperature rise within a decade or so. No human survived that.
Yeah, and it's this exponential growth part of climate change that we don't grasp as humans. We expect things to take a long time, geological time. It's going to take a long time for anything to change, but that's the key factor that's unfolding here, is with the ice melting, with the ocean acidifying, with the temperatures going up and the weather patterns changing, and all these things start adding to each other, along with the 37.5 feedback loops that are now fully irreversible, that when these things start adding to each other, they multiply with each other. And that now the chance for a speedy shift, we're on the verge of that, or maybe already even in it, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're in the midst of abrupt climate change, and most people I speak to want to believe that that's not true, that we're still...
Most people?
Mm-hmm. We're still in the linear phase,
yeah,
of climate change, that it's been slow in the past, and it's slow now, and it'll be slow in the future, and the self-reinforcing feedback loops, blah, whatever, all we have to do is divest, and we'll be fine.
Right, and that gets us back to where
it
gets us back to this key thing, because I'm feeling this March thing, I'm feeling this, you know, I want to feel like there's hope. I want to feel like good things are happening. I want to feel like the Rockefellers are doing good things. I want to feel like there's a good push going in the direction on the good side of this ledger. I've been hanging out with this guy too long. There's so much on the not so good side of this ledger that almost reaching for anything on the good side. And I think that's the underlying thing here with the Rockefellers and 350 and whatnot, is that there's a feel-good involved, that a whole bunch of people got to march, and that a whole bunch of organizations are, quote-unquote, coming together. But we still have no plan. We have no way of really saying, this is something new that we can do that will change this. So we're stuck in this education phase without the ability to organize a plan that we could then implement.
And that next is the plan, right? It's beyond education, you're saying?
Well, yeah, organize and then act. But as Tim Garrett pointed out, the only way to stop runaway climate change is to terminate industrial civilization. So I don't think a lot of people are going to be organizing and acting for that.
Right, so now we're stretching for what else? We give these talks, and at the end people say, what can we do? What is there to do? There's got to be something, right? We're so caught up in our history of, well, there's a problem, you fix it, right?
Yeah.
And now we hit a problem that's more, as Guy likes to say, it's more of a predicament.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not a problem. Problems have solutions. Problems can be found in math books, and the answers are in the back. This is a predicament. There's no answer. There's no answer to abrupt climate change.
Huh.
I mean, you're going to terminate industrial civilization. Who's going to vote for that?
I don't know.
That's what provides gas at the gas station and food at the grocery store and water coming through the municipal taps. Who's going to vote to terminate all that? We've come to expect it.
Is it nature that determines that?
Yes.
Nature's batting last, as we say, right?
Nature bats last. Yes.
And
nature
so
will
on.
Determine that.
I met a man on the climate train that I mentioned at the top of the show that I just got off the train to New York City to the march, who is a metallurgist, about 70 years old, and he was not part of any of this. He just happened to be on the train with us and was very interested, and he got what you're talking about very simply. He said it's entropy. Entropy is as much a law as gravity, and that as systems become more and more complex, entropy sets in, and it's going to work its way through.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a long train ride, yeah.
Evolutionarily, we are selected to believe linear change, backward and forward. And that's worked for us as a species for a long time. But now we're in the midst of exponential change. And our little brains have a tough time
beyond
most
people's brain, math acumen.
Right. And it doesn't match our evolutionary experience. So it's perfectly understandable that we don't know what's going on.
Oh. Yeah.
You know, our brains are still a couple million years old, or at least 250,000 years old. We have the same brains we did a long time ago.
There were brilliant astronomers and brilliant knowledge for a long time.
Right.
They could see these things, even.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. People have seen where we're at. They've seen this coming for a long time. But that's a small minority.
Right,
who sees
it's
coming.
A really hard sell,
yes,
as they would say in the United States of advertising. But the analogy I love that I think helps frame it is imagining monkeys when they first found fire. And they were able to use fire in lots of great ways, but they didn't realize what they had in their hands. And after using it in all these great ways, they got a little careless with it or just didn't even know. And next thing you know, they burned down the jungle.
Mm.
Right? And that analogy for me really rings true, that it's not our fault. You know, there's some kid the other night was saying, oh, I feel so guilty about all this information. You know, and Guy was saying, no, you know, it's not about guilt. It's not our fault, if you will. But it is our experience to be with.
And I tell people all the time, no guilt, no blame. No guilt, no blame. We're born into captivity. We just showed up. We didn't vote for this. We just showed up. Boom, we're here on the planet. We're looking around. I didn't buy into any of this. I didn't vote for this, but here I got grid-tied electricity. I got water coming through the taps. I got the military-industrial congressional complex, which is what Eisenhower called it for the first mini-drafts. And finally, he was convinced to take out the congressional part and it became the military-industrial complex.
Oh, yeah.
And none of us voted for that, but here we are. None of us voted to have the most lethal killing force in the history of the world representing us and providing all that we think we need. But here we are. And so there's no guilt. There's no blame. There's approximately a 40-year lag between emissions of carbon dioxide and temperature rise.
Hmm.
So the temperature rise we're seeing today results from activities in the early 1970s. Guess what? We burned more than twice as much fossil fuel since 1970 as we did in the entire history of our species before that. All of that is baked into the cake at this point, but we haven't realized the temperature rise from it yet. And 40 years ago, we didn't know squat. You and I were just starting to drive cars.
Huh.
We were just discovering our driver's license,
right?
And we didn't know that the emissions coming out of the tailpipe at that time would be manifest when we're in our 50s.
Yeah.
So there's no blame. There's no guilt. there's living here now and accepting the reality that we're immersed within, but without blaming ourselves, and doesn't do any good to point the finger at anybody else either, because most of the people who are getting the finger pointed at them are dead or on the verge, and we're the monkeys with the fire, right? Or Jane Goodall, who threw the bananas into the chimpanzees that were all getting along just fine. And then the bananas showed up, and suddenly they were fighting and kicking and gouging each other's eyes out. Whoa, a cheap energy source. I'll kill you for this. Well, there we are.
Yeah. And like the Matrix came up at one of the talks the other night. You know, it's yeah. like it's really a Matrix situation here where we're born into this grand illusion and we can't see out of it. Minus some major event, some Morpheus coming in and giving us the choice of the pill and giving us a peek into what's really going on here outside of the world you were born in. And that's the experience that I think we're having as humans right now.
Humans, yeah.
Do you have any statistics or measurement of I've heard some really high estimates on maintaining the cloud and data, how much energy that takes.
The cloud apparently, and I'm a little fuzzy on which it is, it requires about 10% of the energy or 10% of the electricity that is used. I don't know which one of those it is. There's a big difference between those two. Electricity is significant. But it's, I think, on the order of a third of the total energy we use. You know, it doesn't keep up with the cars we drive and that sort of thing. But either way, 10% is a large number. So even if it is only 10% of our electricity, maintaining the cloud is a big deal. That's a lot of energy.
Maintaining the cloud, yeah. When did that get started? I've just discovered it.
Right. It must have been within the last very few years. Right. I don't think the cloud dates to 5 years ago, and maybe not even three. So it's a brand new thing. It's one of those things, like all this technology, it's a heat engine. Right? It seems like a good idea. It seems an incredibly efficient way to store information, to store data. And so why not go that route? And well, next thing you know, there's the law of unintended consequences. Whoa, that takes a lot of energy to maintain that. And that's where that entropy idea comes in that James was talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Entropy. You know, this the whole thing is breaking down and there's no stopping it. They don't call it the second suggestion of thermodynamics. They call it the second law of thermodynamics.
The climate change debunkers call science junk. Is that their only defense? They just don't think it's real.
Yeah, what is the best defense? What is the best argument of a denier?
Yeah, I don't know.
He should. He's pretty quiet for like over 3 seconds right there, though.
That was
weird.
Dead
air going on in Santa Cruz, California right here. That's not good when the good doctor's on in front of a microphone. We need a break. Play that wonderful world song or something so he can think about an answer.
You have stumped the panel. You know, okay. And I was involved in a forum involving one of the leading climate deniers just a few months ago in Powell, Wyoming, and apparently I'll have a debate with Anthony Watts of What's Up With That within the next few days.
Yes, up in Chico on Wednesday, you'll be debating one of the top debunkers in the world.
Right.
So I was prepping you here on
And I can only imagine what sort of silly things he'll say that aren't true. And what happened in Wyoming, I think it was in June, I sort of foresaw the major arguments that H. Layton Stewart was going to come up with. And so I went first, and in 20 minutes, I went through all of the arguments he was likely to come up with, and I disparaged them with data, all of them, and pointed out that they couldn't possibly be true. And then he got up and just said them anyway. Not relying on any data, not relying on any refereed journal literature. He just continued to say things that I had just demonstrated strong evidence against using the journal literature. And so I think the argument is to just keep saying the same thing over and over and over again until first you believe it yourself, and then maybe you start to convince other people.
Gotcha. I know one of the big arguments is that CO2 is not so bad, that CO2 and temperature don't necessarily have to mimic each other.
Right, and they say that it's a small increase in a gas that is not very important in terms of its composition in the atmosphere. Right, we're measuring it in terms of parts per million. So it's just a little bit of carbon dioxide. And yeah, it's increased 40-some percent since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, but it's just a little amount of a little gas. What could possibly be wrong with that going up a little bit? And it's been warmer in the past. That's another one of the favorite arguments. It's been really warm in the past. Yeah, but not in human history.
Oh, details.
You know, it was warm and there were dinosaurs and snakes the size of yellow school buses in the Amazon. But we are not going to survive in that kind of world.
And isn't carbon in the air is good for plants, I remember somebody saying.
Right. That's a common approach. And in fact, in greenhouses, carbon dioxide is often piped in. And in fact, that helps overcome the boundary layer between the atmosphere and the plant to pump more carbon dioxide and therefore get more carbon into the plant. Plants are comprised of a bunch of carbon. So if you want to grow more plant, you add more CO2. And that works fine as long as you overcome all the other constraints on plant growth. And you can do that in a greenhouse. You can add water and fertilizer and provide excellent soil for them. But in the real world, you add more carbon dioxide and you get all kinds of other untoward aspects as well. So you don't just add carbon dioxide. What that does is it heats up the planet. And as it heats up the planet, you get profound temperature swings. So it's really cold and then it's really hot. And the plants can't survive the really cold and really hot. They can survive the increase in carbon dioxide, but you're not just getting one thing.
It's not just an a la carte rapid climate change extinction thing.
I just ordered carbon dioxide. I didn't order the temperature changes that go along with that.
Clearly told the waitress.
You're going to have to take that back.
No weather change.
You're getting no tip for that. I'll tell you that, Missy.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we don't just change
you can't,
one thing.
Can't buy it.
Well, there's been a drought like this 800 years ago in California. I thought what he was saying was that, so what's new about this? And I said, well, you know, it's the proliferation of these extreme weather events everywhere, all over the place. A tsunami in Santa Cruz. You know, that was the same storm that hit Fukushima. And so in the past, we've had some extreme things that we can read about in history, but it's just happening all over the place now.
Right. It's an extreme event every few weeks or months now. And these are 100-year and 1,000-year events that historically have happened every 100 or 1,000 years. Yes, there was a big drought 800 years ago in California, and there were like 12 people living in California at the time, right? And they were indigenous people, and they didn't rely upon big farms in the Central Valley at the grocery store to survive. So, yeah, there have been big events, and some of those events have completely destroyed past societies.
Yeah,
and we're talking figuratively.
We don't think that'll ever happen
California
again.
Had a very big Indian population, but again, they were off of.
I was exaggerating ever so slightly when I said there were 12 people living here, but there weren't nearly as many here as there are now. You know, they undoubtedly suffered as a result of the drought, and probably some societies completely collapsed.
We don't have record of.
Right, I don't think people are looking forward to this society completely collapsing as a result of this drought.
No, they're not. But in the few short minutes we have, what is some kind of Band-Aid? What's a little
good feeling at the end part there?
All right, I have good news.
No, you don't
news.
Have to.
No, I have good news. I always finish my presentations with a Hollywood ending.
Yes.
Because everybody loves that.
Of course.
Here's the good news. You get to die.
Sorry.
And the odds against that happening are truly astronomical. Because that means you got to live.
Yeah.
And the odds against DNA coming together in this physical form to comprise you and you and you and me, the odds against that are truly astronomical. That's like winning the lottery every week for years. It's essentially impossible for this collection of DNA to come together. And yet, miraculously, here we are. So we get to die, and that makes us the lucky ones. And people ask me all the time after I give a talk, what if you're wrong? What if all the data are wrong? What if all the projections are wrong? What if all the models are wrong? And in fact, you're just wrong, and we won't experience abrupt climate change. And I say, you still get to die. Even if I'm wrong, you still get to die. And that's great news, because it means you get to live. So let's live. Live now. Let's live here now.
Live here. Live here now.
Yeah, that's the whole story. Even if you live to be 100, you're going to remember these few moments. Let's create wonderful, joyous, joy-filled moments while we're here.
Beautiful. Guy McPherson, here in Santa Cruz, with Peter Melton and James Wolfe. We have Cheryl, Stephen, and anyway, Guy McPherson will be speaking the next time in Monterey tomorrow at a Pilgrim. Well, whatever you said.
Pilgrim's Way Bookstore in Carmel from 1 to 3, and then 5 to 7 at the Monterey Peace Center.
Yes, that's Sunday, so be sure to come there. Oh, at the Peace Center as well.
Peace Center in Monterey on Saturday, and then Sunday is the climate panel here at the Resource Center for Nonviolence on 612 Ocean Street, Santa Cruz, California.
And you can catch it all at guymcpherson.com at the Coming Events tab. All the details, all the addresses, all the times.
Yeah. And he's got movies and he's got books.
Lots of good stuff. And thank you so much for having us on the show again. It's a delight to get to share with you and connect with you and the folks of Santa Cruz and the internet forever beyond.
Thank you, Coral. I appreciate it.
You've been very very forthcoming, and I feel we've become friends in these last days.
What can be better than that? We're always in our last days.
Yeah. And I appreciate your time here, and thank you for using it here and talking to us. So, all right, Santa Cruz, you've heard the news. Thanks for tuning in.